All right, we are calling the matter of Pegasystems Incorporated versus Appian Corporation, record number 1399-22-4. And I understand that we have Ms. Monday and Mr. Rosenkrantz for the appellant. Good morning. And that we have Mr. Lofton and Mr. Mongi for the appellee. Good morning. Now, I understand that it's possible there may be some time that is divided between the various counsel. To the extent that there is, I would ask that you allow me to take note of how much time is being divided. Ms. Monday, will there be any time divided on your side?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. And Ms. Oh, but will you be reserving any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 8 minutes, please.
Thank you. And Mr. Lofton, will there be any? Oh, no, Mr. Lofton.
I sat back here. I know you gave us permission, but I didn't want to crowd the table.
I appreciate that.
No, we will not be dividing.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, so the appellant may begin, and you may take the podium.
May it please the court, Monica Monday on behalf of Pegasystems. It's my pleasure to introduce to you my friend and co-counsel, Joshua Rosenkrantz, who is a member of the New York Bar and has been admitted pro hoc vice in this matter. Mr. Rosenkrantz will be arguing on behalf of Pegasystems. Thank you.
And it's such an honor to be introduced by Ms. Monday, who's worked so collegially as a partner throughout this case.
That's wonderful. Whenever you're ready to begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Josh Rosenkrantz representing Pegasystems. Your Honor, the largest verdict in Virginia history is the result of a series of cascading errors that pose a threat to trade secret law and to competition in Virginia. I'd like to use my limited time today focusing on four assignments of error. The first is that this case should never have gone to a jury because Appian extinguished any trade secret protection as a matter of law. The second is that at a minimum, a new trial is required because the court gave the jury an unprecedented instruction that it was totally irrelevant how many other people learned this trade secret. Third, the court absolved Appian of the requirement to specify what each trade secret is. And then finally, perhaps most remarkably of all, the court gave another unprecedented instruction, relieving Appian of any burden to prove causation, even though Appian now admits that it had that burden. On the reasonable measures, two undisputed propositions require judgment for Pega. The first is that there is no dispute about the controlling legal principle here. It is a rule of law. If you divulge your trade secrets to others, you must require a promise of confidentiality from them. And the second, it is undisputed that Appian disclosed the same information that was disclosed to Zoo and that Zoo disclosed to Pega to thousands of developers just like Zoo and did not tell those developers, whatever you do, do not demonstrate this software to others. Don't show them what these screens look like, and don't tell anyone of its weaknesses. Now, in preparation for this morning, it struck me that the briefs don't necessarily explain to the court who these developers are. And so just a moment on that. Appian sells this tool to customers, like, say, Amazon was once a customer of Appian's, which then uses the tool to create software. Just they're sort of blocks that you put together. So the tool is a sort of eases the function of creating the software. Developers are simply employees of Amazon that Amazon gives the tool to and says, for example, create an app that helps us manage our inventory. Those employees, and there are thousands of them across all of these customers that Appian sells to, use these tools to make the same sorts of apps that Zoo made. The alleged trade secrets, then, relate to things like menus and buttons and visuals that any of these developers can see on the screen. Now, with that backdrop, Let's look at, really, there's one page in this entire record that drives the result here. It is the terms of use that the developers sign, the thousands of them. It's in the January addendum on page 646. It's just three paragraphs that the court needs to look at. The developer, again, this is a developer at, say, Amazon, accepts it with an online click, just the way you would click for any app that you want to download to your phone. Appian concedes at page 26 of its brief, it says not one word about confidentiality. Now, it would have been the easiest thing in the world for Appian to tell the developers on that click-through, whatever you do, don't demonstrate the software, and any discussion of the platform's weaknesses is impermissible. It never says that to any developer. Now, that is not how you protect trade secrets that are worth billions of dollars, Your Honor. Appian posits that every one of these thousands of developers, and by the way, there were 44,000 of them over the course of the relevant period, would know that they had that confidentiality obligation because they would go to their employer and look at their employer's license. But how in the world would they know to go to their employer, and what would they see if they went to their employer's license? That agreement doesn't say, whatever you do, tell your employees not to show this platform to anyone. It says, and this is on page 46, 685, it's section H5, it says that the employer must keep confidential, quote, information or materials that reasonably should be considered confidential. It's circular. It doesn't tell even the employer, make sure that your employees don't demonstrate this software or don't talk about the weaknesses. And, of course, there's no evidence that any developer ever saw this agreement either. So that's all I was going to say about the reasonable measures before turning to the very closely...
Could you address the free trial users for a second, too?
Yes, Your Honor. There were 12,000 free trial users in this period. They also, and just to be clear, what I say about the free trial users does not affect anything that I've said about the developers. They also have an agreement. They've got their own terms of use. That talks about the confidentiality of the software, but it doesn't say to them either, whatever you do, don't demonstrate the software to anyone, and whatever you do, don't talk about the weaknesses. If I may turn then to the second issue. Now, a central issue before the jury was whether these very sparse and imprecise confidentiality obligations that Appian claims to have imposed, even though there's no evidence of it having imposed them, were reasonable measures to protect what it now says in its own mind was secret. Appian's central theme throughout the case, throughout the appeal, that is, on the first issue that I discussed, is it's all about reasonableness. Let the jury decide. But the court issued an unprecedented and sweeping jury instruction, and it's at page 42860, and it said as follows, and I quote, "The number of users of the Appian platform are not relevant to any issue in this case." No court has ever issued an instruction like that, and it is just plain wrong. As the Virginia Supreme Court said in MicroStrategy, Wutz's definition of trade secrets requires proof that, quote, the efforts are reasonable under the circumstances to maintain its secrecy. The number of people to whom you divulge a secret is certainly one of those circumstances, and there's no way to know whether a measure is reasonable or not.
Would your position be the same if, in fact, there were clear confidentiality requirements on every single person involved?
My position would be the same, yes, Your Honor, because the confidentiality requirement that you impose on one person may be different from the confidentiality requirement that is reasonable to impose.
And I understand, but I'm asking you to assume a hypothetical that there are 44,000 and each one has an absolutely binding confidentiality agreement.
Your Honor,
would the number matter in that case?
The number would matter. If it were, for example, 90% of the United States and all you've got is this agreement that is a click-through, and the 90% of the United States is told, don't tell the other 10%, the jury should know that. That's one of the circumstances. The jury can conclude that that is not the way, a reasonable way to protect the trade secret. It's all about what a jury can conclude. Let's talk about it this way, Your Honor. Scenario one, consider two scenarios. So scenario one is Appian licenses its platform to one customer who then authorizes a highly trusted developer to use the platform. Well, then a jury might be able to say, well, that's reasonable for Appian to extract no promise or this very modest promise of confidentiality directly from that developer, because the employer understands the business, the employer knows this is super secret. Contrast that to the reality here that you, Judge Friedman, referred to earlier. Now there are 44,000 developers, and it had this very sparse, and I would say non-existent, confidentiality agreement. Of course it matters to the jury in determining reasonableness whether it's one or 44,000.
Relevance is kind of a low bar, right?
Relevance is indeed a low bar, and what the court did was to say the 6,000 of developers before Zeus started, that's irrelevant. The 44,000 by the end of the damages period, that's irrelevant. The 12,000 people who, to your question, Your Honor, used the free trials, that's irrelevant. The fact that Appian had so many resellers who were also authorized to demonstrate the software that it could not even keep track of how many there were, that's irrelevant. The fact that Appian had no idea how many people saw the software through that process.
It seems to me that since this is a question of trade secrets and whether or not trade secrets were divulged, that the more important inquiry is whether those persons, whether it's one or 100 or 100,000, were obligated under a confidentiality agreement, not the exact number, but whether they were obligated.
Your Honor, I would say that the obligation is the more important of the two, but that does not mean that the number is irrelevant for the reasons that I've been describing. You could have very robust obligations, but if the employer shares it with the entire country or with 90% of the country or possibly even with 44,000 people, the jury can get to decide, you know what, that's unreasonable. Not as a matter of law. I'm not making an argument that as a matter of law that evidence negates confidentiality or negates trade secret protection. But it's a jury question. Let the jury decide how many is enough, especially in light of the fact that these obligations were not as clear as Appian portrays them to be.
Doesn't Pegasystems sort of operate, at least initially here, under a supposition that this is very confidential because the way they go about it, hiring Mr. Zhu, we're going to call you Matt, some people won't find out who you are. Can you address that aspect of it? Because you certainly have that aspect here of this seems to be pretty confidential. We've got to find out about this in sort of a undercover way.
So, yes, Your Honor, a couple of things to say about that. The first is that just because Appian made it hard for one competitor to see the secrets does not make the trade secrets confidential, does not make the information that it wants to keep confidential trade secret. It doesn't undermine the legal point that I was making at the beginning. Secondly, if the question relates to this numbers issue and the relevance of numbers, The fact that Appian made it difficult for this particular competitor to see the trade secrets, again, doesn't undermine the relevance of the entire set of circumstances that the jury is allowed to consider. I think another way of thinking about the question, Judge Beals, is just because Appian makes it hard for competitors to see the trade secrets does not change the legal rule that I was mentioning earlier, that you extinguish your trade secret rights. That's a direct quote from Ruckelshaus. The trade secret rights are distinguished when you share them with others without a vow of confidentiality, and especially when you share it with 44,000 others, because that makes it so easy for the trade secrets to get in the hands of others. If I may turn very briefly to the identification question, because I want to make sure to reserve time for the causation issue. On the identification issue, everyone agrees with the absolute minimum that Appian had to do. To quote Appian from page 29 of its brief, quote, a plaintiff must identify the contours of the secret information such that the jury may reasonably conclude that there was a trade secret at issue. Now, if Appian had sufficiently identified its trade secrets at trial, it would have been the easiest thing in the world for Appian to quote in its brief to this court, here's how we described this trade secret. Here's how we describe that trade secret. Instead, Appian did what numerous courts have said you can't do. It describes a known capability by label. It admits in footnote 7 of its brief that every single one of these labels was known, that is, the ability to perform this function was known. And then it cites hundreds of pages of testimony and says to this court, as it said to the jury, you figure out what the trade secret was. All it does in those pages, however, is with respect to each trade secret, it says it's the architecture and design of each, but it never says what. And it's really suspicious that it's the same description for every one of these five trade secrets that are the supposed crown jewels. It never told the jury, it never told us, what is it specifically about the architecture? So just by way of example, out-of-the-box mobile. Now, that is simply the ability to take an app that is made on a desktop and move it over to a smartphone, and it works on the smartphone out of the box without reconfiguring. Now, Appian says that it described to the jury the specifics of the architecture of that trade secret, but look at the transcript of the video that it cites. It's at 37068-69. It is literally one sentence. Zhu says, this tempo page can be viewed by that mobile user. Petronio says, oh, so it just works, right? Zhu says, yeah. Appian never identifies the secret architecture or what the secret design was. Beyond that, none of the documents that Appian cites in that section of its brief show anything about how to achieve that capability. The same is true of every other function. Again, Appian concedes that the name of the function was known, that's at footnote 7, and then it repeats as to each the catch-all phrase that there was something about the, quote, architecture and design of each capability that was secret. But Appian never says what it was about any of the five. Now, we cited multiple cases. Your Honor, it looks like you're about to ask questions.
Well, I guess I'm a little puzzled because Appian had this Dr. Marshall, who it seems to me actually testified in a lot of detail about the architecture and design, and leaving this an issue for the jury to decide whether or not they had sufficiently pled the trade secret.
Well, Your Honor, I would encourage you to ask Appian, tell me the description that Dr. Marshall gave for any one of these, certainly for all five. They can't do it. Because as to each, yes, he was on the stand for a long time, and he said, he showed videos. He said, look, the jury, to the jury, look, this is what Zoo showed. So he shows Zoo showing the feature, which is really just, here's how you build an app. Here's how you make that inventory function for Amazon. He was showing the software and building an app, but Dr. Marshall never says as to any of these, here's the architecture. And this is in stark contrast to what the cases have said is permitted, is sufficient, and is not sufficient. Here's what the cases have found to be impermissibly vague. Trandis, Fourth Circuit, quote, engineering formulas and methods of calculation. Nexcom, Second Circuit, quote, vague labels, rudimentary graphics, and high-level concepts are not enough. The plaintiff has to say, quote, what exactly the HD video cloud architecture encompasses. Now, this one is telling because it's about software architecture, and it said, tell us more than just its architecture. Ninth Circuit.
I don't want to hijack you, especially as time is dwindling down, but just a quick question. Is it your position that for the specific trade secrets that they may or may not have established, were they required to tie their damages to that?
No, Your Honor. We asked the trial court to issue a jury verdict that specified each trade secret one at a time. That would have been the better practice, and the better practice would have been to tie damages to each one. But we're now in a world where there was, but it's not required. We're now in a world where there was a general verdict. So if any one of these trade secret descriptions isn't enough, you can't support the entire damage award because it's very clear that one trade secret or three out of five wouldn't have yielded the same damages. I do need to, if it's okay, to turn to the causation instruction. Now, underlying this unprecedented damages award is an equally unprecedented instruction. And this one is really remarkable and really scary to anyone who cares about competition in Virginia. That instruction relieved Appian of any burden of proving causation. And it permitted the jury to award Appian billions of dollars of damages based on nothing more than Pega's total sales. Now, that instruction raises two questions. The first is whether the instruction was wrong. The second is, okay, well, what should the instruction have been or what should it be on remand? The answer to the first question is easy. Appian now concedes that VUTSA imposed on Appian, this is a quote from page 51 of their brief, quote, an obligation to prove causation in the first instance. Now, I challenge Appian here and now to quote a single sentence in the jury instructions that tells the jury that Appian had the burden to prove causation. Not a sentence that says the jury must find causation. That's not enough. A sentence that says that Appian must prove it. Appian will not be able to do it because it's not there. And although Appian now admits that it had that burden, Appian told the jury exactly the opposite. Five times over, at every turn in the summation, I'll quote for you one of them, 43206-207. Quote, we just got to show all the money that flowed in, the $6 billion plus from their customers. That alone requires a new trial. So let me just briefly say what the instruction should have been. Litz's plain language answers that question. The complainant must prove damages, and that is prove every element of damages. The General Assembly went out of its way to change the language of the model statute to if a complainant, this is a quote, if a complainant is unable to prove, that change must mean something. So I see I'm out of time and into my rebuttal time, but I do want to stop if the court has any further.
Just a clarifying question then. So the instruction GG is what you think should be used on remand, the proposed jury instruction GG.
Correct, Your Honor. That's the instruction we requested, and that would be the correct instruction under Virginia law.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenfeld.
May it please the court, good morning. Robert Lofton from McGuire Woods in Richmond. It's my privilege to introduce Mr. Adil Mungi, who was lead trial counsel for Appian below and was admitted pro hoc vice for these proceedings. He'll be arguing for Appian now.
Thank you, Mr. Lofton. Welcome, Mr. Mungi.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Pega is a publicly traded company that, by its own admission, hired a spy to learn about one of its top competitors, then used fake names, fake companies, and stolen credentials to learn more about Appian, information it could not otherwise access. All of this was done at the behest and with the intimate involvement of its entire senior executive ranks, led by its CEO. Pega does not even contest now that it violated the Virginia Computer Crimes Act. And yet, Pega is here now without a hint of contrition, suggesting that its predicament is the fault entirely of Judge Richard Gardner and the jury below, who, according to Pega, got just about every major decision wrong in the course of hearing a 7-week trial. But every argument that they make was made to the jury below and was rejected on an extensive factual record. This case had over 30 witnesses, more than 500 exhibits, most of it put in by Appian, record 53,000 pages long. On that record, Pega cannot show that there is no credible evidence to underpin the jury's decision, which is what it must, nor can it show any clear abuse of discretion on the court's evidentiary rulings when each of those rulings was driven and caused by Pega's own strategic choices and sharp conduct in discovery and at trial. And when it comes to burden shifting, the court's instruction was consistent with law around the country and entirely appropriate. Now, let me address the issues in the order that Mr. Rosenkranz raised them. First point he raised is he said, well, Appian chose to make its trade secrets public. Everyone could access its software. There's nothing secret here. Well, the record is to the contrary. Both sides' evidence confirmed that Appian's trade secrets were well protected. From the Pega side, multiple witnesses attested that for Pega, Appian was like a black box. Multiple witnesses used that phrase independently. They told their CEO, when he was driving for more information, that his questions were impossible to answer without access to a system, which they then used all the subterfuge to obtain. From the Appian side, there's testimony from fact witnesses like Mr. Malcolm Ross, an executive at the company, and expert witnesses like Dr. Eric Cole, the country's leading cybersecurity expert, about the extensive measures Appian took to protect its trade secrets, including legally binding confidentiality agreements, but also going far beyond that. Firewalls, multi-factor authentication, encryption, checking user registrations, he said these were best in practice. Mr. Ross testified and made clear that Appian never made its software available without license terms that always had confidentiality in them. That's at 38324 of the record. Now, Pega has pointed to zero evidence in the 53,000-page record.
How did that apply to the free trial users?
The free trial users, Judge Friedman, had their own agreements that they entered into that required, among other things, they had to keep the materials confidential, could not share with competitors, and could not mask their identity. And, of course, Pega people came up with fake names and fake identities, so they expressly violated those terms. Now, Pega cannot point to any evidence in the 53,000-page record of a single Appian trade secret at issue here being exposed to anyone without a confidentiality obligation. Not one example. And Mr. Rosenkranz has no answer to the question of, well, if all of this is out there so easily accessible, why did you have to do all of this to get access to it? As Judge Beals, you asked, you know, they recognized what they were doing with a spy, don't let it get back to Appian, mask his name, blur it on screenshots. They went through a lot of effort to keep this secret, and they understood that was the only way they could get this access, and the factual record is replete with evidence about that. Now, what Mr. Rosenkranz points to in the main today is he says, well, Appian had these developers out there, and what about them? Well, again, the factual record here is very clear. For any one of those developers like Mr. Zhu, they had to sign terms of use, but those terms of use made clear that use of the software was subject to the terms of a separate license agreement. That's in the January addendum at 646. And they made clear that if you don't have a separate license agreement with Appian that entitles you to access, you're not allowed to use it. Those license agreements that were incorporated by reference then made clear, because these are the agreements with Appian's partners, they made clear many, many different ways that the information had to be treated as confidential, could not be reverse engineered, could not be shared outside of the bounds of the license. And those partners, like Serco, which employed Mr. Zhu in this case, followed through on their obligations and bound their developers, like Mr. Zhu, to express confidentiality obligations. Mr. Zhu was expressly prohibited from using the software for anything other than his work at Serco. He wasn't allowed to sell it at night to Pega. Mr. Zhu was expressly prohibited from misappropriating Appian's trade secrets. So he was covered many different ways. The testimony is clear from Mr. Ross and others that this layered protection was applied across the board. There is not a developer who had access to it who was not cognizant of this. Mr. Zhu himself knew that he was not at liberty to share this information with Pega. He did it anyway. Now, then Mr. Rosenkranz transitions from that argument to saying, well, what about this jury instruction, saying that the number of people who had access is irrelevant. The jury instruction of which Pega complains was a curative instruction necessitated by its own misconduct and strategic choices at trial. And let me explain the context here. Starting before trial, Pega's argument was exactly what the law says it cannot do. It wanted to argue that the mere fact that you have shared this information with many people, albeit under confidentiality terms, means that it undermines its status as a trade secret. And we cited to the judge in a motion in limine case law that made clear that is not the law. This goes back all the way to Justice Holmes in the Supreme Court a century ago in the Board of Trade case, and the Supreme Court of Virginia confirmed the same principle in MicroStrategy versus Lee, which is that you will not lose protection of the law, that's the phrasing in the case law, if you are sharing your agreement only under terms of confidentiality. And our amicus, like the Chamber of Commerce, make clear how fundamentally important that is in an industry like software and high tech, because otherwise...
So your position is the number of people that have access to it doesn't matter so long as all of them are under a confidentiality agreement.
Absolutely. And that is...
Because then zero people can reveal it properly.
Because the test under Wurzer, Judge Friedman, is not whether you had this under a hermetic seal. The test is, did you take reasonable measures in the circumstances to protect your trade secret? And having confidentiality obligations, multiple cases make clear, is absolutely sufficient. It's a necessity in modern commerce, especially when it comes to high tech. And let me note for a moment, Mr. Rosenkranz talks about this is the biggest verdict. Yeah, but consider the fact that the Chamber of Commerce is in here asking you to uphold that verdict. That tells you how important it is that trade secrets be protected, and that indeed this type of protection through license agreements, be upheld by this court as appropriate. Consider, for example, the analogy of government secrets on your point, Judge Friedman. Government secrets, a lot of people have access to them. It doesn't mean they're not secret or you're free to go hand them off to a foreign power. Now, in this case, the court considered all of those precedents, and I'll commend to you in particular Judge Walz's decision in the District of New Jersey in the SyncSort case, which was a software case just like this one. And Judge Walz noted that the distribution of the software there was to thousands in the stream of commerce, went through the precedents, addressed how these agreements are central in the software industry, and confirmed that distribution to thousands
does not destroy secrecy, but rather reinforces it. And that's exactly what we have here. And indeed, he even pointed out, you know, you can have situations where it's a trade secret, even though everyone knows it, because that is the principle on which modern commerce is founded.
If the reasonableness of the efforts is part of the equation, and if the number of people that this information is floating around to could impact how the jury views that, is it a comment on specific evidence, this instruction? And is it, you know, again, relevance is a low bar. Tell me why.
Yeah. That doesn't change the analysis, Judge, and here's why. In considering our motion in limine on this issue, the court specifically asked Pega what their goal was here in trying to get this in. He confirmed on the record that their argument was just as Pega thought, to argue that the mere number of licensed users undermined trade secret protection. That's at 8918 of the record. Now, that argument is irreconcilable with the admonition in the cases that you may share your trade secret without losing the protection of the law, because the whole argument is, no, you undermine it if you share it under confidentiality. So that's point number one. It's completely irreconcilable with that, and they admitted that was their purpose. That was the basis for his ruling. But there are three reasons, Judge Friedman. That's one. The second reason is, on this record, there was zero evidence, zero, of a single instance where anyone under a confidentiality obligation failed to live up to it, other than Mr. Zhu. Maybe there's a different case where, yeah, there's leakage all over the place, your agreements don't hold up, for whatever reason you haven't taken reasonable measures. Maybe then there would be an argument like you posit, Judge Friedman. But it doesn't exist on this record because there's zero evidence of that, none whatsoever. But there's a third reason why this instruction was appropriate, and let me point out why. The judge made the ruling that he did based upon the principles in the cases that I just talked about. But thereafter, Pega deliberately violated that ruling on multiple occasions. In the opening statement, they waved around a thick printout booklet of licensed users to try to suggest this very point. Later in the case, the trial registrants you were asking about, Judge Friedman, they did the same thing to try and suggest that, look, just the number, this can't be a trade secret. Now, in those circumstances, Judge Gardner did absolutely the appropriate thing, which was to issue a curative instruction consistent with all of the cases that we've talked about, saying, you know, that is not something that comes into this analysis, and of course the instruction must be considered, as always, with regard to the facts of the case. And on this case, on this record, that was absolutely appropriate. Okay, so that is their suggestion that everyone has access. Let me turn to their argument that we didn't make clear what our trade secret is, or that somehow that's some mystery. Let me address that very clearly. Again, the Virginia Supreme Court in the MicroStrategy case said whether something constitutes a trade secret is, quote, best resolved by a fact finder after full presentation of evidence from each side. That is exactly what you have here. Can they show there's no credible evidence in the record to support what the jury did? Mr. Rosenkranz issued me a challenge when he was up there. He said they cannot take you through a single trade secret and show you where it is or even explain to you what it is. Let me do that. Let me start off with, there are really two aspects of this. There's the law and then there's the facts. Let me start with the legal piece of it. The starting point is, of course, the statute. And WTSA makes clear it has a definition of what a trade secret is. And a trade secret is just means information. And there's a non-exclusive list. That's all it has to be, information. There's no other parent qualification. So it's information, then, that meets two standards. One, it derives independent economic value from not being generally known to, not being generally ascertainable by proper means by people like Pega, who can get value from it. And then is the subject of efforts that are reasonable in the circumstances to maintain secrecy, as we spoke about earlier. The Eastern District of Virginia, in another MicroStrategy case, MicroStrategy versus Business Objects, said the case law is clear that just about anything can constitute a trade secret under the right set of facts.
And the law makes clear that trade secrets can reside in the architecture and design of software. And they don't dispute that. In their opening brief, they sort of do, but in their reply brief at page 4, they admit, yeah, those can be trade secrets. Now, what does that mean? Mr. Rosenkranz suggests, you know, that's some abstract thing, no one can understand, it's not a real thing. Well, we cite, for example, the Fabcom case, which dealt with software, bond trading software. It's from Judge Mukasey in the Southern District of New York. Specifically says, you know, source code, sure, that's one thing, that can be a trade secret, but so can architecture and design. And specifically, what are they talking about? Quote, the format, structure, and organization of the software. When you get into software, you explore what are the process steps, what's the layout, what's the methodology. That is what Fabcom is talking about. We cite a number of other software cases that say the same thing. To make this simple, you know, consider a non-software. I understand software, the concepts are a little abstract, but take a non-software concept. Let's say you have a company that comes up with a very innovative new way to design a brand new, novel-to-the-market car. And in that factory, they have a very innovative design layout of the machines and the product flow and the distribution line. And they guard that carefully. The only people who can come in and see it and study it have confidentiality obligations. Now, if a spy breaks in, he studies all of that. He looks at how things are laid out, what's the production line, where are the machines, how do they do, how are they calibrated. And then he goes and gives all of that to a competitor. What has he done? He's misappropriated the architecture and design. The concepts are no different in the trade secrets world when you apply that across. Monogram Snacks, which we cite in our papers, is an example of just that, a trade secret on the layout of a factory, making chicken chips, whatever those might be. But the same concept applies here as well. Now, let me take up his challenge on a specific example. Let me refer you to custom data types, the architecture and design of Appian's custom data types, which we address in our brief. Let me note this first. Dr. Marshall was qualified, and Judge Collins, I saw you noted this, he was qualified as an expert in the field of architecture and design of computer applications, development platforms. So he was testifying on exactly this point. What did he explain? He explained that CDTs refer to the unique way in which Appian organizes processes and stores data in its platform. Now, that's critical in this industry because programs built need to be able to pull upon vast amounts of data quickly and easily. Pega had a way of organizing this data, but it was very specific to how Pega operated. Developers had a long learning curve. The information and the data was stored in the far corners of their platform. They had to do a lot of work to get to it. They had to have a lot of specific knowledge on how to do it. Now,
and so, Mr. Manji, so what if we take your point that Appian sufficiently, through its expert witness, established that the architecture and design was unique and specific to Appian, sufficient that it made it an issue for the jury? What about the jury instruction regarding causation? Can we get there?
Sure. On burden? Certainly. Let me turn to that issue, Judge. So this is instruction number 14. That they're referring to. Now, I'll set aside for a minute the issue of should the restatement be applied in Virginia consistent with the rest of the country. Let me just focus specifically on the instruction itself. Now, the case law is clear that jury instructions must be read, number one, as a whole, number two, in the context of the evidence that has been submitted in the case. And those two principles are important here. Let me point out two things about instruction number 14. First, in the opening paragraph of instruction number 14, the jury was instructed that Appian bore the burden to, quote, prove by greater weight of the evidence its claim for misappropriation of trade secrets against Pegasystems. Now, what is misappropriation under WTSA? WTSA defines misappropriation, and it means use of a trade secret of another without express or implied consent. And then it goes on from there, but that's the key part of that definition. For the improvements trade secrets, considering, of course, the evidence against which the instructions must be evaluated, our theory of the case, which we had argued for 7 weeks, had been that Pega used
are trade secrets and therefore misappropriated by incorporating them into its platform to make its own improvements. That was the focus of Dr. Marshall's testimony, many documentary exhibits, and cross-examination of their witnesses.
Can I follow up on, because your time goes by so quickly here, as you know, follow up on Judge Callens' question. And that is, in looking at jury instruction 14, it seems, as you just noted, that it, clearly PEGA has to show that there were misappropriated trade secrets. That has to be shown here. Appian has to show that. Sorry. Appian has to show there are misappropriated trade secrets, but then just show what Pegasystems' profit was or sales. That is that second prong of the test seen in that jury instruction seems to be a very low burden. Why doesn't Appian have to show more than just what their profit was for the second prong?
Sure. Well, there are two reasons for it, Judge Bills. The first is, I'll disagree with you a little bit on looking at that in isolation, because I think you have to look at that against the rest of Instruction 14. By the time the jury got to the piece that Your Honor is pointing about, they had already had two things. One is they had to find...
I hate to interrupt you, but I do want to make you aware that when you make that answer, it's clear that y'all argued that the law puts that burden on the misappropriator, not the victim, that all we have to prove is sales. So that's how you exploited the instruction. So when you answer that question, keep that in mind.
Absolutely, Judge Friedman, I will. So before the jury gets to that part of the instruction, they need to be satisfied that we have the burden of showing PEGA misappropriated. And by misappropriate, that means they used it. So they used it, so the jury has found they took our trade secret and they used it to improve their platform. Then they're additionally instructed in 14 and in 12 and 13 that they can only award unjust enrichment caused by the misappropriation. Now, when you take those two things together, there is nothing else that is appropriate here for the jury to be instructed on, because they have already found that PEGA misappropriated our trade secrets, used them, therefore, in their product, and their use in the sales of their product in and of itself constitutes a nexus, a connection between their conduct and the harm to us, because we're competing against that platform. That is all that trade secrets law requires, a showing of a nexus. And because the only thing that the appellate courts are concerned...
A showing of a nexus and a showing of overall sales. And
yes. Once you have established the nexus, then it moves to sales. And the important point there, a nexus is important, Judge Friedman, to your point, because what the appellate courts are concerned about is, yeah, but what if you got some information but you never actually did anything with it, right? That is excluded, precluded by this instruction, because in finding misappropriation, they found use. And they found use in the arena that competes with us precisely. So then, when they get to the calculation of unjust enrichment against that background, and that background is critical, the question is, does that make sense as a way to calculate unjust enrichment? And I will suggest to you it absolutely does, Your
How
Honor.
How does that align with our code section, though, which seems to imply that you have to consider the actual loss caused by the misappropriation?
That is the exact language that was in the jury instruction, Judge Collins, caused by misappropriation. It's there in 12, it's there in 13, and it's there in 14.
So, but the next part of this jury instruction says that, the relevant part, that you're looking at the gross sales, not necessarily the sales that are related to the appropriation. And it seems like that is the standard.
Well, so what the case, why does that make sense? Is that your question, Judge Collins?
It would be my question.
Okay, so the Milgram's treatise on trade secrets, which is the leading treatise here, addresses that issue. So does the Petters case from Washington, and so do many other sources. And the logic they lay out is this. Once we have established, let me put it in the framework of this case. Once we've established that PEGA stole our trade secrets, incorporated them into their platform, that's what misappropriate means, they used it, then how do we establish, okay, so what are the unjust enrichment damages here? Now, what the case law says and Milgram says is, look, it makes sense
to put the burden of parsing out any innocent sales on the misappropriator. Why? Because they're the ones that have the information about what went into each sale. They're the ones that have the incentive to bring that forward. We, Appian, have no way of accessing their hundreds of customers around the country. They're the ones that have access to it and the incentive to bring that information forward.
Counsel, I understand your point.
Yes.
And I understand where you're coming from on your point. I have two questions for you on it. One is, you're citing Petters, which, as near as I can tell, is the only court that's ever made this instruction, and then the Washington Appellate Court came back and said that was an error. And two, you're advocating burden shifting, and I would like to know what you think about MicroStrategy versus Lee, because the Virginia Supreme Court has said we don't burden shift and we don't reverse the Virginia Supreme Court.
Yes. So let me address those two issues, Judge Friedman. So first, when it comes to the later case in Washington, ADA Motors versus Butler. Now, that is a case, first let me point out that in ADA Motors itself, this is all dicta. The court makes clear it's not an issue that they needed to reach in that case, but they do. Now, in that case, I respectfully submit they got it wrong. And let me explain why they got it wrong, because it's the same reason why PEGA gets it wrong here, because they want the same instruction. What they want to happen is that the first step of the burden shift, at the first step, they want Appian to show only sales attributable to the misappropriation, right? Not anything wider than that. Now, if you do that, you have written out burden shifting. There's nothing being shifted then. We're in here, we're going to establish our case, we're going to say everything is based on it, we're going to show why it's attributable to the misappropriation. What are they going to do in response? Well, like any defendant, they'll say, no, we disagree, here's why. But there's no burden shifting happening there at all. So the ADA Motors instruction, by definition, precludes the whole notion of there being a burden shift. It's inconsistent. It's wrong. That is why Judge Gardner here studied these cases very closely, including the ADA Motors, and his considered view was the ADA court got it wrong. Petters is the court that got it right. Why? Because the logic of burden shifting is consistent with the approach that we advocated and the court adopted, but the logic of burden shifting breaks down completely when you adopt their approach. Second, on MicroStrategy versus Lee, the burden shift there, Judge Friedman, other than the fact that the phrase burden shifting is at issue, has nothing to do with this. Why? Because in that case, the question was, can you shift the burden of proving liability, of showing that there was misappropriation? Or is it enough to say, no, they have to prove independent derivation? And the court there said, no, of course, you have to prove liability as the plaintiff. That is consistent with the law everywhere in the country. There's nowhere in the restatement or anywhere else where a court says, oh, yeah, you can shift the burden on proving liability. Unjust enrichment is a very specific, focused thing. And the reason why burden shifting makes sense there and not in any other context or for any other damages remedy is because there is a fundamental asymmetry of information. The defendant is the one who knows about its sales and indeed about their cost structure. The plaintiff does not. That issue doesn't apply to anything else, including liability, because in liability, we can come in and make our liability case. Now, on that same point, I do want to point to one other fact, which is this issue that Mr. Rosenkranz didn't address but is related to what we're talking about, which is interrogatory number 18. Because, remember, when we put in our evidence, Your Honors, we didn't know there'd be burden shifting. It hadn't been decided yet. So we went to prove our case the best we could, and we asked an interrogatory that was designed to get specifically at their information about the revenues from the platforms that are at issue. And PEGA's whole response in their reply is, no, you know, that was something about versions. We never understood it to be about revenues from the platform, so it's very unfair to hold us to that.
Well,
I just wanted to...
The question did say versions, and then they attached other documents.
Yeah, it asked Judge Friedman for a breakout, right? But the question was asking for revenues received by PEGA relating to PEGA, and then it listed the versions, but that's the platform. They're all versions of the platform that is at issue. And we just asked for it to be broken out because we wanted it as granular as possible. But We were asking for revenues from the platform, and they understood it because...
But you didn't say revenues from the platform. You said revenues from the versions, and shouldn't you be held to whatever the question was that you actually asked?
Respectfully, no, Judge Collins, because everyone understood the question, even Pega. Here's what Pega said at 39054. The court asked Pega, so this revenue that is reported here in answer to the interrogatory is the revenue derived from those platforms. Pega's lead trial counsel, yes, that's correct, goes on to say the question simply asks for the revenue from the platforms. The court, and you gave your total revenue, their answer, that's correct because that's what the question asked. So they understood it. They cannot now approbate and reprobate. They understood it then. They gave the answer. It's the same thing that we were asking for. So it was entirely consistent on all sides. And there is a fundamental logic when that is what we relied on.
Are discovery answers binding, or are they used as evidence if something comes in is at odds with them?
I'm sorry, Judge. Could you repeat that?
Why is it fair for this one interrogatory answer to literally gut all the damages evidence? You could have used that answer as evidence at trial to tell the jury what they said.
Yeah.
But this is a really massive penalty.
Yeah.
And you did ask for versions. So just tell me.
Yeah. There are two may I answer?
Please.
Please.
Okay. There are two reasons for that, Judge. The first is, not only did everyone understand what the question was asking about and on all sides was consistent with that, but then we relied on that information throughout our expert work and our trial presentation. So to allow Pega to then come in at trial and say, you know, forget about all the work your expert did, now we're changing our minds, would have been fundamentally unfair and prejudicial.
And yes. Suppose, and I know we're going over time, but
sure.
Same question in reverse. You did not object to the computer and the software. They answered the software question, and it came in without, or, you know, they put it in their exhibit and nobody objected. Then at the last second, y'all dropped an argument that the software is different from the computer.
Yes. So
why aren't you held to the same standard?
Sure.
You let it go and you didn't object.
Sure. So just on the last question you asked, let me just add one other point. The other evidence on the revenues was consistent with the interrogatory because we had testimony from their CFO saying 90% of revenues are from the platform. They don't track anything beyond that. Okay. On the software, same issue. This is a problem of their own creation to our prejudice because two aspects here, Judge. First, on their exhibit list, they listed laptop. There was only one laptop in the case, which is the one that they had produced to us. They had an obligation under the scheduling order that was in place in this case to identify any exhibits for trial and to give us copies of each exhibit listed. They never gave us a hint of saying, we're looking to use something new here, something other than what we gave you. And so when they turned up at trial, in the middle of trial, and said that, we said, we don't know what's on this. We have never seen this laptop before. Our expert has no way of looking at it and studying whether it's the same thing or whether we're being sandbagged with something that's been altered. This is a case where the other side was accused of and was found to have engaged in willful and malicious misconduct. So we weren't going to take their word for it. And in that situation, once they had made that choice, foregone easy resolutions through discovery, but ambushed us at trial, Judge Gardner's view of this is something you should have dealt with in discovery.
But
so
I guess I'm troubled by the fact that both you and Judge Gardner seem to place emphasis on the laptop when Pega was trying to introduce was actually the software. And wouldn't you agree that there's a distinction between software and laptop?
There certainly is, Judge. But again, it's all a problem of Pega's own making. If Pega had wanted to, they could have produced their software just like all other productions in this case through an electronic file transfer. In fact, they did that for some later versions of the software. But when it comes to the pieces we're talking about, they chose to produce it on this laptop. And so the fundamental problem
But the laptop acted as hardware. It just acted as a mechanism through which to produce to you the software.
Yeah.
But you knew that the software was what was responsive to your discovery.
Sure. And it would have been perfectly fine for them to bring in that software on a different laptop if they had told us at the time of their exhibit list or during discovery or even some reasonable period before trial that, look, we're not going to use what you have and what you've studied and what you've looked at and what your expert has assessed. We're going to have something, we're going to have it in some other form, and you better look at it so you can make sure and satisfy yourself it's the same thing, that it hasn't updated spontaneously, it hasn't been changed, it hasn't been altered in any way. Easy solution. This gets done at trial all the time. You ask the other side, okay, here's Lotus, come and inspect it, make sure you're fine. But it is on trial lawyers, Judge, to line up their evidence and have it ready for admission at trial in a way that there's no surprise or prejudice. Pega chose to take the risk of standing up in the middle of trial and saying, here's something you've never seen before. And that's what created the problems here, fundamentally.
Do you agree that in Virginia, electronic documents stored in a computer generally raise no authentication issues, MidKIF?
Well, electronic documents, in other
the
words...
The software is...
I would suggest...
As opposed to the laptop. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I would suggest, Judge Friedman, that actually software raises very unique concerns in this regard. And in fact, the Court of Appeals has expressly emphasized that in the Knowles case that we cite in our papers by pointing out that software is particularly susceptible to tampering and unidentifiable alterations. It's a quote from the case. So it's particularly important when it comes to software, especially in a case like this, where there's disputes about what was in what version, etc. It's critical that we have the ability, before they show up at trial, here's something new you've never seen before, that we have a chance to study that for our expert to assess it and analyze
it. I'm sorry,
it.
But it just didn't seem like you were questioning the integrity of the software. You were questioning the integrity of the laptop. And again, isn't there a difference?
Well, remember, Judge Collins, there are two separate laptop issues here. And let me just separate them because I think your question goes to that issue. First, there is this new laptop that Pega chose to ambush us with a trial. And that was precluded for the reasons that I talked about, we're surprised by it. But then Judge Gardner gave them the opportunity and said, but go ahead and use the laptop that you produced. You know, that's
there's
fine.
There's an issue of a key related to...
No, that was all resolved. That was not an issue. The issue with their laptop was they had chosen sharp practices during discovery days before a report was due to provide that software on a laptop that was underpowered. And so when they sat there in court and they tried to turn it on, they got it on, but they couldn't get it ultimately to load the software. Judge Gardner was sitting there for a long time with the jury waiting, giving them every opportunity to get it up and running. They couldn't. Why? Again, their own issue. They chose to produce it in this format. So it should not be for the appellate courts to rescue parties from their strategic choices at trial. That's exactly what happened here. And by the way, let me point out also from the Knowles case that we just talked about, in that case also the court said, you know, even if you weren't allowed to use your laptop, use your electronic record, you were allowed to talk about what was in it. And that renders any error on this issue harmless. That's also, by the way, just what happened here. The judge allowed them to talk about what was in the software at length. They did exactly that.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Your time is up. I appreciate it. Mr. Rosenkranz? And it looks like you have 7 minutes and 7 seconds.
Yes, and I noticed Mr. Mongi went way over, so I hope
we will certainly extend to you the same courtesy.
Thank you, Your Honor. So let's start with causation. And I'll start with Judge Friedman's question and Judge Collins's question as well. I mean, the Supreme Court has said it, that the plaintiff must prove at least lost profits with proof of proximate cause. That's Banks. Lost profits is right next to unjust enrichment in the same statute. If one needs to be proven by the plaintiff with evidence of proximate causation, so does the other. To Judge Friedman's question, Appian also ignores two Virginia Supreme Court cases that say that when a statute does not prescribe burden shifting, There is no burden shifting. And it does not dispute that MicroStrategy in particular applied that rule with a syllogism. And I'm quoting the two pieces of the syllogism. The first, quote, the plain language of VUTSA does not provide any burden shifting requirement. Therefore, the court says, quote, the burden does not shift. Now, I challenged Appian to...
I recognize that, but what do you say to Appian's position that that's really not what it means in the context of that case?
Well, so Appian is making an argument for the first time in oral argument that is not in its brief. And as I understand it, it's making the argument that because it was because they tethered their case to the software being used, somehow they've proven proximate causation of use. They didn't get $2 billion of revenue because the software was merely used by virtue of the misappropriation was merely that we got our hands on the software. They got $2 billion because they claimed that we caused because they claimed that the misappropriation caused all of our sales. Now, I challenged Appian to read a sentence in the jury instructions that said that they had the burden. They could not do it. They just kept referring back to this use concept, which I frankly don't understand. Mr. Mongi says that all they had to show was nexus. I don't agree with that. The jury wasn't asked whether nexus was shown. And so they can't get anywhere by saying that the jury instruction on the retrial should be nexus, because nexus was not what the jury was what the jury was told to ask. And Judge Friedman, I mean, you are right that Appian exploited this. They exploited this with a vengeance. They said to the jury exactly the opposite of what they admit here before this court.
Well, they only exploited it if the instruction is wrong.
Yes, right. And the instruction was wrong for all of the reasons I gave, but they exploited it at 42996 to 97, at 43206 to 11, 213 and 214. Let me turn to the software.
Can I ask you a question before you turn to
that? Of course, Your Honor.
So, I understand your argument that Appian had to certainly show more than just what the profits or sales for Pegasystems were, and that's what jury instruction 14 says. But in the jury instruction GG that you want to be utilized on remand, if it were to be remanded, basically it requires that Appian show the sales proximately caused by each allegedly misappropriated trade secret. How would Appian show, given that there are a lot of allegedly misappropriated trade secrets here, how would they begin to show how much is related to each single one of those, given that Pegasystems would have a lot more access to that sort of information than Appian would?
Well, Your Honor, so two things to say about it. First, if that was the problem with the jury instruction, which, by the way, there were long colloquies about amendments to jury instruction number 14 and whether it was better to substitute the word causation in there, we preserved that. But if that was the problem with instruction GG, Appian could have said, hold on, wait a minute. It doesn't have to be a trade secret by trade secret enumeration. Damages experts can certainly do that if that's what they want to do. But we didn't lose this over the fact that we specified per trade secret. We lost this over the fact that we wanted the court to put in a causation requirement into instruction number 14. Right before this case went to the jury, we went back to the court and said, wait a minute, can you please just insert that phrase, causation, caused by, for all of the trade secrets? Now, the court asked about the software exclusion.
So you would be satisfied with that sort of instruction?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
A general causation instruction.
General causation would have been totally fine. The problem is that Appian was relieved of causation entirely. Now, the court asked some questions about the software exclusion, and I just have to emphasize, this was really unfair. Before trial, Pega put the software on the exhibit list. We said a Pega laptop. We brought a Pega laptop. This notion that there's only one laptop in this whole case because that was the device by which we transmitted our software to Appian during discovery is completely foreign to the law. And there was no ambush. A week before introducing this, we sent Pega an email saying, we just want to make sure you understand we're bringing a laptop. Do you want to examine it? They could have done anything they wanted to in that week. Pega then attempted to authenticate the software, which is what you do with any piece of evidence, including software. There is no software exclusion to the authentication requirement, with a witness who had firsthand knowledge, who could have said, I know where this is stored. I'm the lead developer of version 6.3 and of version 7.1. I know where it's stored. I downloaded the software to Appian directly myself. This is the same software. But the court wouldn't even let us try to...
Did you present that or proffer it? You proffered it, right?
Yes, we proffered that, Your Honor. We proffered
Bixby. Because there wasn't even an authentication hearing, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. We proffered it through Bixby, who is the premier expert on what we have on our systems. And Appian has not argued that our proffer was inadequate. So the court did not even allow us to try to authenticate. And the only justification the court gave is the only thing that Mr. Monkey did not talk about in this in his presentation, which is that we had to use the same laptop that it was produced on discovery.
Well, did he not say that it would produce a trial within a trial?
Yes, that authentication would produce a trial within a trial. You could say that about any authentication. The way authentication is usually done, as this court well knows, is either you agree to it before trial and everyone is on the same page that this is authentic, or you put on a witness and you say this is authentic, and Appian is totally free to say, it's looking at the images that are played to the jury, they're totally free to say, hold on, wait a minute, something changed. We know Pega software backwards and forwards. You change something. But, of course, bare speculation that someone might have changed something is not a basis for excluding software. Lastly, on numbers, we never said that the mere fact that you have a lot of users will cut off the trade secret protection automatically. We said that it's relevant. Mr. Monge quotes from 8918, but he truncates the quote. What we said was, the facts here are actually not that all these people clipped I accept and agree to these terms and conditions. This is the whole question, whether you give the trade secrets out to this many people and leave this many doors open in your contracts. We were talking about the confluence of the sheer numbers of people who are given this click-through that doesn't even say that you are supposed to promise not to show software to anyone else and not to explain its weaknesses. Mr. Monge says that there are a lot of employers with a lot of employees. Again, we're not saying that trade secrets is always destroyed where there are a lot of employees or a lot of people who sign confidentiality agreements. We're saying, to your point, Judge Friedman, earlier, it's relevant. It's relevant. The sheer size of the universe of the disclosure is relevant to the reasonableness of the procedures that a jury can consider. Every case Mr. Monge points to finds, as a matter of fact, that the trade secret is protected. As a matter of fact, despite the sheer numbers, that's what happens in a lot of cases. In fact, all of these cases that we cite, the number is cited as a fact for the fact finder to consider.
Can you give us a 30-second rundown on the 6.3, 7.0 versions issue?
The discovery, interrogatory 18?
Yes, Your Honor. On the versions versus products. Mm-hmm. So having improperly shifted the burden to Pega to do all of the apportionment, the trial court then gutted our defense. And in here, it is remarkable what Appian and Mr. Mongi do not dispute. Appian doesn't dispute that the evidence that we proffered demonstrated that much of Pega's revenue was attributable to products that with which Appian did not compete and that were totally different from from the BPM product at issue here, that this evidence was highly relevant to causation, and that barring this evidence left the jury with a crucial misunderstanding that we had literally no defense. Now, Appian barely tries to defend the trial court's ruling. Appian doesn't contest that, to Your Honor's point, the general rule is you're not bound by a discovery response. And Appian's complaint that they were sandbagged by this is completely absurd. These are very, very sophisticated lawyers. They know what was on our platform. They know how we keep our revenues. We had an expert who wrote a report that was based upon the point that different products are sold to different customers. They deposed that expert. That expert report got eliminated by virtue of this discovery, by virtue of this one interrogatory. And as several of the judges noted, the interrogatory wasn't even about version. It was not even about products. It was about versions. If Appian wanted information about products, they could have asked for information about products. If there are no further questions, I thank the court for its attention, and we respectfully request that the court reverse the judgment.
Thank you very much. We'd like to say thank you to all counsel.